Our next speaker is John Preskill, who will be talking about quantum information science and its power to provide new methods to go after some of the most fundamental questions in physics. John?
Okay, thank you very much. It's always exciting to be back at PI. This meeting is about the convergence of ideas. That's a topic that I find very interesting. But I also have on my mind today another amazing convergence, the convergence of this event with my 40th wedding anniversary, which is itself a celebration of a convergence, a union that was created that became more than its parts. And I realize the rest of you don't care about this convergence as much as I do, but it's been a great 40 years, and I thought that had to be acknowledged somehow. Now, the field I'm representing is itself the result of a convergence of three great themes of 20th century science: quantum theory, computer science, and information theory. Quantum information science is a synthesis of those themes, addressing deep questions at the interface of physics and computer science, and also perhaps pointing the way toward revolutionary future technologies. Now, this field has gotten a lot of its intellectual energy from the quest for a quantum computer that will be able to solve hard problems beyond the reach of ordinary digital computers. And there are three compelling questions about quantum computers that we try to address. Why would we build one? What are the applications of quantum computing? Can we really build one? Or are there obstacles that could block our path? And how will we build one? What kind of quantum hardware will be used to reach potentially scalable devices? And a lot of my own research effort over 20 years has been devoted to these questions. The third question in particular has sparked a burgeoning experimental activity involving many people and many approaches to realizing quantum hardware. And it's important for the time being that all these different types of quantum hardware be pursued. We don't really know yet which technologies will prove to have the best promise for scalability to large devices, and future quantum technologies may make use of hybrids of these different approaches. The experimental activity is part of the reason that this field has been growing. It has been the fastest growing of the units. The topical group on quantum information has been the fastest growing of the units of the American Physical Society since it was founded 10 years ago. And it also has the highest percentage of student members. Young people are attracted to this field by a convergence of two things they're passionate about: computers and quantum physics. But I've expected for some time that as quantum information science matures, it will connect more and more with other areas of physics and other problems closer to the core of physics. There's a new frontier of physics that's opening up, what we might call the complexity frontier or the entanglement frontier. It's different from the short distance frontier we explore in particle physics or the long distance frontier of cosmology, although it has things in common with them. But it's also very fundamental and exciting. Only in this age are we for the first time acquiring the ability to construct and control very complex quantum systems, systems that we're unable to simulate with ordinary digital computers, which can therefore behave in ways which will surprise us and lead to important discoveries. And already the ideas that we're developing by thinking about quantum information are having an impact on other areas, like the study of quantum phases of matter and even the quantum structure of space-time itself. One measure of the convergence that's been occurring between areas, or one of the convergences, is that as a crude measure, we can look at the papers on the high energy physics archive, which use the word entanglement in the title, entanglement being a buzzword of quantum information. And there's been explosive growth, we can see in the last couple of years, as people working in particle physics are recognizing more and more the relevance of quantum entanglement to the problems they're interested in quantum field theory and quantum gravity. And what I want to do is to give you some idea why this is occurring and where we think it could lead. But first, what is this quantum entanglement, which I've already referred to, which is the basis of much of the excitement about quantum information? Well, put succinctly, when a quantum system is very highly entangled, what we mean is that even if we have the most complete description of the whole system that the laws of physics will allow, we're still powerless to predict what we'll see when we look at a part of the system. So imagine a book which is 100 pages long. If that were a classical book, you could read 10 of the pages, and then you'd know 10% of the information content of the book. But if this were a highly entangled quantum book, and you looked at 10 of the 100 pages, you'd acquire very, very little information that distinguishes one highly entangled book from another. And that's because the information residing in the book isn't encoded in the individual pages. It's encoded almost entirely in the correlations among the pages. And if I want to read the book, I would have to make a complicated collective observation on many pages at once. And in fact, these correlations are very complex to describe in terms of classical data, so that if I had a small number of qubits, the quantum analog of bits, which might fit on a single page of that book, and I considered some typical, highly entangled quantum state of just a few hundred qubits, if I wanted to give a complete description of all the ways in which those qubits are correlated with one another, I would have to write down more bits than the number of atoms in the visible universe. So it's never going to be possible, even in principle, to write down a complete description using classical data of the full quantum state of a relatively small quantum system. And that property was very intriguing to Richard Feynman. It led him to make the suggestion in the early 1980s that if we build a quantum computer, which processes qubits instead of bits, we might be able to perform tasks that are beyond the capability of any conceivable classical computer. Feynman's idea was that if we can't even express in terms of bit the content of the quantum state, then by processing the quantum state, we ought to be able to do things that a digital computer would never be able to emulate. I came to Caltech in the early 1980s when Feynman was thinking about these things, and we had offices on the same corridor. And we often talked about physics, particularly quantum chromodynamics, the theory of the strong interactions. One of my regrets is that we never talked about quantum computing because I had no interest in the subject at the time. But that was going to change, and one of the people responsible for changing my life was Peter Shor, who's in the audience today. Around the time that Feynman was suggesting the idea of a quantum computer, Peter was an undergraduate math student at Caltech, and like most Caltech undergraduates, we gave him a very well-rounded education, which included quantum physics, and somewhat later, he put that knowledge to work and made a remarkable discovery, an example of a problem that we believe is hard for ordinary digital computers, is finding the prime factors of composite integers. And what Shor found is that if we have a quantum computer, that becomes an easy problem. It's not much harder than multiplying numbers together to find their product. And when I heard about this in 1994, I was really awestruck. very impressed by the idea that the boundary between hard and easy problems, the difference between problems that we'll never be able to solve and problems that we will be able to solve with advanced technologies, that's a different boundary than it would have been if we lived in a classical world instead of a quantum world. I thought that was one of the most interesting ideas I'd ever encountered. And thinking about it eventually led me to change the direction of my own research from particle physics to quantum computing. Now, does anybody care that factoring is a hard problem or an easy problem? There are people who care, because the crypto systems that we all routinely use to protect our privacy when we communicate over the internet are based on the presumed hardness of problems like factoring. When quantum computers are widely available, we won't be able to protect our privacy in the same way. There are alternatives, but it's not exactly clear yet what will be the best way to maintain privacy in a post-quantum world. But the really important thing that Shor's discovery pointed to is that there's an intriguing classification of problems. There exist problems which are hard for classical computers and are easy for quantum computers, which makes it a very interesting question to understand what other problems are in that class. Not all problems can be solved by quantum computers. The problem has to have a structure which is well matched to the special capabilities of a quantum computer. And I think after 20 years of research, to me, still the most interesting potential application of a quantum computer that we currently foresee is using it to simulate the real-time evolution of complex quantum systems, like chemical reactions among molecules, the properties of materials, quantum field theory, and even quantum gravity. So I'd like to have a quantum computer, but I don't have one yet. And why is it taking so long? Well, it's actually a hard problem. And part of the difficulty is that we have to overcome a formidable enemy that we call decoherence. That is, quantum information is very fragile and easily damaged. Physicists sometimes like to muse about a quantum state of a cat, which is a superposition of the live and dead state of a cat. But we never observe that type of superposition of macroscopically distinguishable states in ordinary experience. And we understand why not. It's because a cat will always, no matter how hard we might try to prevent it, interact with its surroundings, and those interactions with the environment will, in effect, immediately measure the cat, projecting it onto a state which is either completely dead or completely alive. And this phenomenon, called decoherence, explains why, although quantum mechanics holds sway at the microscopic level, the systems that we encounter in everyday life can be well described by classical physics without the quantum phenomena being manifest. A quantum computer, however it's built, will, although we might try to avoid it, interact with its environment, and that will lead to errors due to decoherence, which will cause a quantum computation to fail. And so we can successfully build and operate a large-scale quantum computer only if we can fight off the destructive effects of decoherence. One way of saying what the problem is that if a quantum state is observed, it is disturbed. And so we want the information that's being processed in the quantum computer to be almost perfectly isolated from the outside world so that none of the information can leak to the environment. Leakage of information is fatal. And that sounds like a tall order because the hardware of a quantum computer isn't going to be perfect, but we want the information to be almost perfectly concealed. But we've learned about the principles of quantum error correction, which make this possible in principle. The idea of quantum error correction is if we want to protect a quantum state, we can encode it in a highly entangled form so that when the environment interacts with the system, interacts with the different parts of the system, no information will be acquired by the environment because, just like with that 100-page book, the information doesn't reside in the individual parts, but only in the correlations involving many parts. And so we can resist the noise and protect the quantum system from decoherence. This quantum error correction scheme will only work if the hardware is good enough. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be good enough. And we would like to have quantum hardware which can perform quantum gates on pairs of qubits in a scalable device where the probability of an error in each two-qubit gate is well below 1%. And we're not quite there yet, but there's been considerable progress in making better quantum hardware. There's still a long way to go to realize the promise of these quantum technologies. I think it'll happen eventually, but it's going to be a long slog. What I want to talk about in the rest of the talk is not the advance of quantum technology or its future impact so much as the way that ideas which have been developed thinking about quantum information and quantum computing are giving us fresh approaches to problems in physics. And to illustrate that, I'll focus in particular on problems in gravitational physics, which have been troubling us for a long time, such as the interior of black holes and the quantum structure of space-time. Well, we've been struggling with understanding the quantum behavior of black holes for about as long as I've been married, about 40 years. Since in the mid-70s, Stephen Hawking discovered that although classically a black hole is something from which nothing can escape, quantumly black holes emit radiation and evaporate, eventually presumably disappearing completely, which raises the issue of what happens to the information encoded in a system that falls into a black hole and then disappears. One possibility is that the information is really lost forever, but that's at odds with the principle of quantum mechanics that the evolution of a system should be microscopically reversible, so information is never lost. The other is that somehow the information manages to escape from behind a black hole horizon, although based on our understanding of black holes from Einstein's classical field equations of gravitation, that's not possible. So thinking about this problem has actually been aided and advanced by quantum information principles already for some time. Now, you might take the attitude that a black hole is an object which emits thermal radiation, and we would expect it to be like other thermally radiated objects. Namely, the process of radiation does not destroy information, but rather scrambles up the information into a form which is exceedingly hard to read in practice, but in principle could be read. Well, perhaps it's the same thing with a black hole. But there's a principle of quantum information that comes into the story, what we call the no-cloning principle. It isn't possible to copy perfectly an unknown quantum state. It's because of this fragility of quantum information. If I want to make a copy, the copier will interact with the system and will, in general, change the state of the system, so I won't be able to make a high-fidelity copy. Now, black holes are different from other thermally radiating systems because a black hole has an event horizon, the boundary of the region of no escape. And that means that the geometry of the black hole is so deformed that, as I've indicated by this green line in the figure on the right side of the slide, it's possible to draw a surface through the space-time, which is space-like, which I can think of as being a surface of constant time, which is crossed both by the collapsing object from which the black hole formed and nearly all of the outgoing radiation which was emitted during the black hole's lifetime. And that means that if all the information in the collapsing body wound up being encoded in some scrambled form in the outgoing radiation, that same quantum information is in two places at once at the same time, and that violates the no-cloning principle. So we seem to be stuck. Either information is really lost, which violates the microscopic reversibility of quantum theory, or cloning occurs, which also calls for a revision of fundamental principles of quantum physics. So in thinking about this over 20 years ago, we desperately formulated the black hole complementarity principle. The idea of black hole complementarity is that it's not correct, for reasons which should be explained by a theory of quantum gravity, it's not correct to think of the inside and the outside of a black hole as two different parts of a quantum system. Rather, we should view the inside and the outside as two complementary views of the same system. The outside view is the one that's appropriate for an observer who stays outside the black hole. The inside view is appropriate for the observer who falls through the black hole horizon. But it's really the same system described in two different ways. And evidence seemed to accumulate for a while that this black hole complementarity idea was on the right track. But then work a few years ago by the group known as AMPS hammered home that there's something still missing from our understanding of this black hole complementarity idea. What AMPS argued is that black hole complementarity is trying to reconcile three ideas, each of which individually sounds eminently reasonable. First of all, that black holes don't destroy information, but scramble it up into a form that's hard to read. Second, that an observer who falls through a black hole horizon doesn't notice anything unusual, at least not right away. Eventually, that observer is doomed to encounter the singularity inside the black hole, but horizon crossing itself is not a noteworthy event. And third, that the observer who stays outside the black hole horizon will see no unexpected violations of the usual laws of physics. But AMPS argued that it's not possible for all three of these beliefs to be true, and they postulated that if we have to give something up, the most conservative resolution of the conflict is to give up on number two, and to say an observer who attempts to fall into a black hole is actually unable to do so and is destroyed at the moment of horizon crossing by a seething firewall. That sounds crazy because it's so different than what Einstein's classical field equations of gravitation seem to tell us. So why would these smart people make such a crazy suggestion? Well, it's because of an important principle of quantum information, which we call the monogamy of quantum entanglement. Classical correlations are polygamous, that is, they're easy to share among many parties. So Adam and Betty might both read the same newspaper, and so they become correlated with one another. But nothing prevents Charlie from reading the newspaper as well, and so now he's just as strongly correlated with Betty and with Adam as Adam and Betty are with one another. But quantum correlations aren't like that. They're harder to share. So that if Adam and Betty are fully entangled with one another, that means Betty has exhausted all of her ability to entangle with Adam, and she's not able to be correlated with Charlie at all. And conversely, if Betty is fully entangled with Charlie, she can't be correlated with Adam at all. That's what we mean by the monogamy of entanglement, and this monogamy can be frustrating, because Betty might want to entangle with both Adam and Charlie, but in order to entangle more with Charlie, she has to sacrifice some of her entanglement with Adam. And this monogamy of entanglement has many important ramifications in quantum cryptography, in the study of quantum matter, but also in black hole physics. So what AMPS argued is this. They said that suppose we consider a black hole, which is very old and has been evaporating for a long time, and so it's now become very highly entangled with the radiation which was emitted during its lifetime. And then I consider some more radiation which is being emitted by the black hole right now. If information is preserved by the evaporation process, then this new radiation B should be very highly entangled with the earlier radiation, the system C. And that should be true if the laws of physics outside the horizon are the normal laws we expect. That should already be true when system B is very close to the black hole horizon. But a second thing we know is that if the horizon looks smooth to an observer who is falling through the horizon, then that means this system B has to be highly entangled with the system in the interior of the black hole. But now we're in trouble because system B wants to be highly entangled both with C and with A. And we can't have it both ways. That would violate the monogamy of entanglement. So what AMPS suggested is that the resolution is that information is preserved, Betty is entangled with Charlie, but the entanglement between Betty and Adam is broken. And that would mean either that a very high energy barrier would be encountered at the event horizon, or that there's no interior of the black hole at all. So it seems that we don't have a clear answer to what appears to be a very simple question: what's inside a black hole? And that the answer that we give to the question in quantum physics may be radically different than the way we would answer the question in classical general relativity. Possible answers are that information really is destroyed by black holes, and then there's no limit to how much stuff can get lost behind the horizon of a black hole, because information never comes back. A second answer is there's nothing at all inside. The black hole has no interior, as AMPS seem to suggest. But I think there is evidence building that the right answer is that we can still rescue a modified form of the principle of black hole complementarity, that is, that we can view the interior of the black hole as an alternative perspective on part of the exterior. But that idea is a bit crazier than we previously believed, because we'd like to resolve the monogamy of entanglement problem by saying, yes, B is entangled with A and C, but that's okay because A and C are really the same system viewed from different points of view. But that means the interior of the black hole is to be identified with a radiation system which could be arbitrarily far away. So this identification of the black hole interior with degrees of freedom in the exterior can be wildly non-local. This question of the interior of a black hole is part of the broader question: is how should we think about the quantum structure of space-time, which is an old question. But lately, I think we're making progress by stating the question in a sharper way, which is, does space-time emerge from entanglement? The evidence is building that we can think of quantum entanglement as the glue that holds space-time together. This evidence largely builds on an insight from back in the 1990s by Juan Maldacena, the bulk boundary duality in quantum gravity. What Maldacena taught us is that we can imagine putting a black hole inside a bottle. We call the interior of the bottle anti-de Sitter space, or we just call it the bulk, and we call the walls of the bottle conformal field theory, or we just call it the boundary. But the principles of quantum gravity are such that everything that occurs inside the bulk is encoded in some form on the walls of the bottle. We call this a holographic correspondence, meaning that everything that's happening in space-time is encoded in some very subtle way on a lower dimensional space-time living at the boundary, a kind of hologram. And on the boundary, there's no black hole, there's no place to hide an indefinite amount of information. And so in this situation where we understand quantum gravity the best, it seems manifest that quantum information is not destroyed in the process in which a black hole forms and then evaporates. But what the AMPS argument has driven home is that we still don't really understand what this picture is telling us about the interior of the black hole, about the experience of someone who falls through the horizon, or even whether the interior exists. So with this tool of a bulk boundary holographic correspondence, we can start to address the relationship between the quantum theory, which lives on the boundary of a space-time, and the bulk. So one thing we can do is we can consider the case where the boundary actually consists of two disconnected systems, and we can ask, what are the consequences for the dual bulk geometry when those two systems are entangled with one another? And in the cases where we know how to answer the question, the answer, intriguingly, is that if these two systems are entangled with one another, and only if, the bulk geometry has a wormhole connecting together the two different boundaries, a shortcut through space. This is not the kind of wormhole that we can use to travel from system A to system B. It's not a traversable wormhole. The right picture is that Alice, A, lives near a black hole, and Bob lives near a black hole, where the two black holes are very, very far apart from one another. But those two black holes in their interior are connected by the wormhole. You might think that if a wormhole isn't traversable, if you can't go from one side to the other, it's not very much fun. But actually, this wormhole really is a lot of fun. If we think of Alice as living near her black hole and Bob living near his, far away, and those black holes are entangled with one another, that means they're connected by a wormhole. And although Alice can't manage to get through the wormhole to where Bob started out, or vice versa, Alice and Bob can both jump into their black holes, and then they can encounter one another and have a fulfilling relationship for a while before they're ultimately doomed to strike the singularity together. Well, this is just the type of non-locality, or it's pointing toward the type of non-locality that we need to rescue black hole complementarity. Because here, Bob, who's near a black hole far, far away, actually does have the ability to influence the interior of Alice's black hole, namely by jumping in. It's not too big a leap to say that a radiation system, which is very, very far away, can be closely related to the interior of Alice's black hole if the radiation and the black hole are entangled with one another. We have another deep hint of a connection between geometry and entanglement from an observation made by Ryu and Takayanagi a few years back. So now let's consider a quantum system which is connected and has a dual bulk geometry. Now, this bulk geometry actually lives in a negatively curved space, and I've drawn that as a hyperbolic geometry to make it easier to interpret a two-dimensional bulk with a one-dimensional geometry. This is actually a Poincaré disk. It's been conformally mapped. All the polygons in the bulk are actually the same size, but because of the conformal mapping, they seem to have varying size, getting smaller and smaller closer to the boundary. What Ryu and Takayanagi told us is this: we can consider taking the boundary and dividing it up into two complementary parts, A and its complement, A complement, and we can ask how entangled are those two parts with one another in a quantum state. And when there's a corresponding bulk geometry, they said the answer is geometrical in the bulk, that in suitable units, the entanglement between A and its complement is the same thing as the area of a minimal surface in the bulk which has the same boundary as A. So there's a precise relationship between quantum entanglement on the boundary and geometry in the bulk, and this has been extended further recently by the work of a number of people. Rob Myers here at PI has been one of the leaders in that work. So I've told you about two rather extraordinary ideas, the holographic correspondence and quantum error correction. I think these are two of the most amazing ideas that I've encountered in my career in physics. And I think it's natural to wonder whether these two ideas could be related to one another. And in a recent paper, we discussed how they may indeed be connected, building on earlier work by these authors. This was a very enjoyable collaboration, and fittingly, the authors' names spell happy. So what we did is we said we can construct quantum error-correcting codes which capture many of the features of the holographic correspondence, providing us with a fresh way of looking at it and thinking about it. So one of the things we'd like to explain is there's a complicated dictionary relating the physics that occurs in the bulk and physics on the boundary. Where does that dictionary come from? How do we understand it? And we'd also like to understand better this relationship between entanglement on the boundary and geometry in the bulk. And what we discussed is a way of constructing a quantum error correcting code given, say, a hyperbolic geometry tiled by polygons. We can imagine a quantum code associated with each one of those polygons, and we can fuse them together to build a big quantum code, a kind of tensor network construction. And so in this big code, all the physical degrees of freedom, the physical qubits in the code, live on the boundary. They are the non-contracted indices in this tensor network. But there are also the logical degrees of freedom, the protected system, which is protected against error, where there's a protected qubit associated with each one of the polygons. And what this tensor network describes is the encoding map, which embeds the system that we want to protect inside the Hilbert space of the boundary system. And with this construction, we can say explicitly what the dictionary is, which relates the boundary variables and the bulk variables. And what one finds in particular is that as we go deeper and deeper into the bulk, the degrees of freedom deep inside correspond to highly non-local phenomena on the boundary. If I apply some local operator in the bulk, the corresponding operator on the boundary is very, very highly non-local. That's the type of non-locality that gives us protection against error on the boundary in a quantum error-correcting code. This non-locality of the operators on the boundary is something expected from the standard bulk boundary duality lore. I can imagine a process in which someone tweaks the interior of the bulk geometry. I apply some local operator deep inside the bulk, and the effect of that excitation will then propagate causally out towards the boundary and reach the boundary at a later time. But until it reaches the boundary, its effects are not locally detectable on the boundary. But even when that bulk operator is first applied, it should have some effect on the boundary system, and that effect is some very non-local logical operator acting on the code space of a error-correcting code, which is very well protected against error because of that profound non-locality. So we interpret the precursors, as they're called, the operators on the boundary that correspond to local operators in the bulk, as logical operators acting on a quantum code well protected against errors on the boundary. So using this viewpoint, we can infer a number of properties of the codes which are reminiscent of the bulk boundary holography in quantum gravity. We can recover this Ryu-Takayanagi relationship between entanglement on the boundary and in the bulk. We can also do the following thing. We can identify a connected region on the boundary and determine what's called the causal wedge of that region, which is the region in the bulk contained in between A on the boundary and the minimal surface in the bulk, which has the same boundary as A. And we can show that any bulk operator which acts in that causal wedge can be mapped to, can be reconstructed as an operator on the boundary which has its support only in A. And that reconstruction is highly ambiguous because for any given point in the bulk, it's possible to choose many different causal wedges in which it's contained, and therefore we can map it to operators on the boundary in many different ways. But that actually is an expected property of the bulk boundary correspondence in quantum gravity, and we interpret it as the ambiguity in a quantum code which results from the redundancy of the encoding, which is the origin of the protection against error. That says that a operator acting on the code space, acting on the logical protected system, has many different realizations as physical operators acting on the physical qubits. And we can also ask questions like this. Suppose we consider the union of many small disconnected regions on the boundary, what are the operators in the bulk which can be reconstructed there, and we find that in some cases, operators very deep inside the bulk can be reconstructed on such a union of small fragments on the boundary. That corresponds to the property that our quantum code provides very good protection against erasure errors, in which some of the qubits are removed. The redundancy in the code construction assures that the logical information is protected, even if some of the qubits are destroyed or become inaccessible. So this is giving us a fresh way of looking at the correspondence between bulk and boundary physics. It needs to be fleshed out quite a bit more, but I'm encouraged that it's pointing us in fruitful directions. So this was an example of how the developments at the entanglement frontier or complexity frontier can have an impact on other areas of physics. And I've only talked about the connection with quantum gravity. There are other deep connections, particularly with the study of quantum matter. And I expect as we continue to explore highly complex quantum states, new concepts will arise which will have, as of now, unforeseen implications for other problems in physics. Now, Juan Maldacena recently had an opportunity to explain to people who work in the life sciences what we're trying to do at this convergence of quantum information and quantum gravity, and he allowed me to borrow this slide, or the concept of the slide. It's like this. Quantum gravity is life, and that's what we really want to understand. The boundary theory is chemistry, and everything about life in principle follows from the principles of chemistry. The quantum information theorists are the chemists, so they understand many things about the intricacy of entanglement in quantum systems. And the quantum gravity theorists are the biologists whose real interest is in understanding more deeply what quantum gravity is all about. And the convergence we want to achieve is molecular biology, combining together what the quantum information theorists know to give us new insights into the properties of life. The black hole information problem is our fruit fly, our toy problem, which if we make great progress in understanding all of its intricacies, will prepare us for even bigger problems like curing cancer and understanding the origin of life, the universe, and everything. Now, if you listen to string theorists nowadays, you might hear a conversation like this, where one says this convergence of quantum gravity and quantum information looks very exciting, and the other says, yeah, but I'm afraid it's hard to work on. And it's true, it is hard to work on, because there are very few scientists nowadays who really have mastery of the tools and concepts of both quantum gravity and quantum information. I'm optimistic that that's in the process of changing. In a few years, there will be many young people who really do have mastery of the tools of the trade in both quantum information and quantum gravity, and that will accelerate progress. So as my collaborator, soon to be a postdoctoral fellow here at PI, put it, now is the time for quantum information scientists to jump into black holes. And great things will result. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, John. Questions? Team?
Hi, I have a brief comment and then a couple of questions about black hole information problem. The comment is, I think what a lot of people have not properly taken into account is that there's quantum back reaction on the geometry of the black hole, and the assumption that there's a singularity in the black hole that even that there an event horizon exists could be wrong because of quantum back reaction. Now, so that's just something I think. So all the question about firewalls and all the problems with entanglement could be resolved if there's enough quantum back reaction. Now, now the questions are, first, could there be some direct relationship between the amount of entanglement between the interior and the exterior of the black hole to sort of a macroscopic quantum back reaction extending out, not just from some central region of the black hole, but out to where the horizon is? And the second is, in ADF-CFT, could ADF-CFT encode information about what's going on inside the black hole as well as outside? I don't see why not myself, but you probably know a lot more about it than I do.
Okay, well, let's take the last part first. Your second question was, does ADS-CFT provide a description in the boundary theory of the interior of the black hole? And I believe that it should, but we don't yet understand how it works. And so when I was speaking of a more radical version of black hole complementarity, I had something like that in mind, that there is a mapping from the exterior to the interior, that we can understand the interior in the boundary theory, because the boundary theory does describe all aspects of the physics outside the horizon, but it's a very non-local and complex mapping, which we have to do a lot more work to understand it. The first question was about quantum back reaction and whether entanglement would enhance quantum back reaction and therefore make it more likely that quantum back reaction would allow us to see a resolution of the firewall problem. Of the information paradox. Yeah. Well, I mean, our current understanding doesn't tell us how to do it, I guess is all I can say. Certainly, the idea of a firewall is a very profound quantum effect in which, it's a kind of quantum back reaction, which is extremely drastic, which causes even the interior of the black hole to fail to exist. So we're already entertaining very dramatic back reaction effects which arise quantumly, which are very different from any classical back reaction. But I think until we arrive at the right way of thinking about these problems, we can't give a definitive answer to your question.
Thanks. So often in different fields of physics, like quantum information or quantum field theory, people start with different assumptions. And if we're going to achieve convergence, we need to sort of understand those different background assumptions. So I wonder if this is an example of that kind of assumption. In high energy physics community, people usually think that you start with some initial conditions and you evolve them forward in time, and that gives you your physics. Whereas in quantum information, people often think in, say, the circuit paradigm, where you have lots of boxes wired together and you have knobs, settings on the different boxes. So rather than having initial conditions, or just initial conditions, you also have some givens that are distributed through the system. So in the context of these kinds of dualities, it seems to me quite difficult to put that quantum information picture in, because if you imagine, say in the bulk, somebody chooses a setting, this setting or that setting, well, that choice of setting would have to be represented in a very complicated way on the boundary. And so it might be difficult to really bring that quantum information point of view into that setting. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, So I think your question is about how should we think about processes in the bulk in which there are agents who have the freedom to do different things, like measure different observables. The corresponding picture in the boundary looks like it's extremely complex because the corresponding action is very, very non-local. And how are we supposed to reconcile those or think about it in the boundary picture? Well, I don't have a very good answer to that either. I guess I would say that there are phenomena on the boundary which are very non-local, and it's probably a good thing and an empowering thing that at least in some cases we have an alternative language for describing them, which is local in the bulk, and that actually extends the phenomena that we know how to discuss in terms of your picture of agents choosing settings and so on beyond the way we really typically think about it now. So, I mean, I think that's a good thing.
Hi, I was wondering if there was a relationship between MERA and the quantum correction code in ADS.
Right, so the question is about another approach to understanding the bulk boundary correspondence using a tensor network picture called MERA, which is the, what is it called, Giffrey? Entanglement renormalization ansatz, which was invented by PI's own Giffrey Bedal, and which also has properties reminiscent of the correspondence. In particular, there's kind of a natural way of understanding the connection between entanglement and on the boundary and geometry in the bulk in that picture. So our description is different in several ways. First of all, the tensor network itself really is uniform in the bulk, which isn't true of MERA. But the more important conceptual difference is that we are only trying to describe in our description of the bulk physics a subset of the boundary theory. And that means that we're not really telling you the complete story because there should be an exact correspondence between things that happen on the boundary and things that happen in the bulk. But this quantum error correcting code picture applies, the way I described it, to the physics of the low energy states on the boundary, which correspond to rather nice, smooth geometries in the bulk. And the way we get this redundancy, which is characteristic of a quantum error correcting code, is that we're only trying to describe a small subspace of the whole Hilbert space. Most of the states in the bulk, and correspondingly most of the states on the boundary, are just really big black holes. And the description that I was giving wasn't intended to describe those.